John Woodrum, representing appellants in this matter, Peabody Holding Company and Black Beauty Coal Company. In November of 2008, the United Mine Workers of America demanded that Peabody Holding Company require its union-free subsidiary, Black Beauty Coal Company, to offer the right of first refusal for jobs at Black Beauty's non-union mining operations to the UMWA-represented miners employed by Heritage Coal Company, an unrelated entity. The Peabody Holding and Black Beauty refused the union's demand. The question before the court is whether, notwithstanding the presence of a broad arbitration provision, that non-union companies may be nevertheless compelled to submit the union's dispute to an individual known as the jobs monitor rather than have that dispute resolved by a federal judge. This is an issue that courts are frequently required.
I don't quite understand your issue. I'm misconstruing it. Are you suggesting that because non-signatories are being bound, that's a problem in this case?
It is.
Or are you arguing about the scope of the clause itself?
The argument turns on the scope of the clause in paragraph 14 of the jobs MOU, which the union...
The district court really didn't get into too much, or you didn't get into too much, as to whether Peabody Holding and the others are bound, because the signature said he was signing as agent for them and binding them, and I'm not sure that that's before us, but maybe is that... I need to understand your issue.
It provides the context for the dispute and the...
I mean, as I understand it, basically the original arrangement was that if somebody gets laid off in Mine A, that he will be set up as a priority hire at Mines B or C in accordance with the agreement. And that arrangement, that first preference of hiring somebody that's been laid off at Mine A to go to Mine B and C, is monitored by the jobs monitor, and that if there's a dispute with respect to that obligation, then the jobs monitor will decide it in arbitration. And I thought the issue was whether the scope of that arbitration clause reaches arbitrability itself.
It does reach arbitrability. That's the basic structure, but the of the way the jobs MOU works, but the critical part of this is that the jobs from Mine A over to Mine B are not jobs of the same employer. They're different employers.
I understand that, but that was the arrangement agreed to.
The arrangement that that was...
All the employers involved agreed to it. Now, if you're arguing that the Peabody Holding didn't bind itself, that's a different issue, and I don't think the district court addressed that.
No, Peabody Holding, there's not a factual dispute as to whether Peabody Holding and Black Beauty Coal Company were initially or originally party to that agreement through their agency.
They bound themselves to hiring on a priority basis the ones laid off from Peabody Coal. Is that right?
They did. The reason for the agreement, the only way the union could even ask for that agreement in the first instance, since the appellants here don't have a relationship with the union, was the existence of the commonality of ownership. So
that isn't what they agreed to. It didn't say because of this or because of that. The fact is they bound themselves. And I didn't know that your argument in this case is that Peabody Holding's not bound. I thought your argument in this case is that the scope of the arbitration agreement isn't as broad as the arbitrator construed.
The latter is correct. We're not.
Well, then what are you giving us all this distraction for?
Because the existence of the rationale of the jobs MOU is that these companies were related entities, and Peabody Holding and Black Beauty complied with this obligation so long as they were subject to common ownership. The sine qua non of the jobs MOU, as a matter of labor law, is that there's a corporate relationship.
Have you preserved that question on appeal? I don't understand I must say I'm genuinely confused.
Our position is that the union is entitled to have a determination made as to whether the severance of common ownership extinguishes the obligation.
That's fair enough. That's an open issue which has not been decided and which is not before us. What the effect of the severance of Peabody Coal, what does effect does that have on the agreement is not before us. That is the issue that you want adjudicated in a court.
That's the issue
but
that the union
the issue
has
in this case is whether the arbitration agreement covers that question.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's stick to that then instead of...
The arbitration agreement, which appears in paragraph 14 of the jobs MOU, which is the underlying document that gives rise to the claim in the first instance, contains direction for an individual who's denominated in that paragraph as the jobs monitor to monitor the job hiring provisions in that that are elsewhere in the substantive portions of the agreement. It does not give the jobs monitor the broad authority to resolve contract interpretation questions, and it contains none of the indicia that appear in broad arbitration clauses that routinely come before this court in the context of collective bargaining agreements.
Your argument is this little agreement is a side agreement that is intended to give, was intended to give, priority hiring to people laid off from Peabody Coal, and that yet had a jobs monitor to enforce it, and that same jobs monitor would resolve disputes over that issue.
Over the provision of the jobs.
Right. And now we have a broader question, you argue, of when you sever out Peabody Coal and sell it to another company, what's the effect on this agreement? And you're arguing the arbitration clause is not broad to get to that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Language of the clause. Okay, I understand your argument.
Yes. There's nothing in this paragraph 14 that resembles what this court in Carson and actually every court, every case that's cited in the both parties' briefs refer to as broad arbitration clauses. Broad arbitration clauses empower an arbitrator under the terms of a collective bargaining agreement to interpret and apply the agreement, resolve all disputes. They're written in various ways, but they're all very expansive, and they make very clear that if a problem arises, then the arbitrator is to resolve it. The parties don't want work stoppages. They don't want strikes. They don't want to have to litigate every issue that comes up in the workplace. The jobs MOU is not, and indeed, that very broad arbitration language appears in the arbitration clause in the underlying labor agreement between Heritage Coal and the UMWA. If that language was in the jobs MOU, we wouldn't be here.
The broad arbitration clause language usually says any dispute relating to this agreement or arising out of this agreement. And those clauses have been interpreted to include the arbitrability of all disputes relating to the agreement.
All disputes except arbitrability itself, which this court said in Carson required a more specific acknowledgement by the parties that they intended arbitrability itself to go before the arbitrator.
Well, I'm thinking of the court's recent Supreme Court's recent case in Rent-A-Car. The clause was shall have exclusive authority to resolve any dispute relating to the interpretation, applicability, enforceability, or formation of this agreement.
Exactly, a very broad arbitration
very broad.
Clause.
And your argument really focuses on the clause here, which is intended to address disputes arising from enforcement of this priority arrangement. That's really the long and short of it, isn't it?
Exactly. That's the nub of this. If the court agrees with us that the...
I didn't say I agreed. I just said I'm trying to find what the issue is.
I understand, and I did denote if the court agrees. But the essence of the present dispute is not related to the merits. It is simply related to whether, as this court and the Supreme Court has said repeatedly, you agree to arbitrate only that which you've specifically agreed to arbitrate, that even if there is an agreement that contains a provision for arbitration, resolution of disputes, whatever you call it, the courts will enforce that But it's done on a dispute-by-dispute basis. Not every dispute, therefore, becomes subject to arbitration.
The language in this particular agreement is essentially gives the job monitor jurisdiction over, quote, any dispute alleging a breach of this MOU. How is that much different than the broad language that Judge Niemeyer referred to?
Because it contains none of that broad language. It doesn't say... These parties certainly knew how to draft that.
Well, it's narrow in the sense that we're dealing with the specific agreement, but it seems to me that any issue that comes within the scope of the agreement, including the scope of the parties bound by the agreement, should be part and parcel of the arbiter's jurisdiction.
Actually, Judge Diaz, I think the fact that it said that the only thing that this agreement delegates to the jobs monitor is the any dispute alleging a breach of this MOU shall first be, the literal language is, shall first be presented in writing to the signatory company, but then it's to be resolved by the jobs monitor. But it doesn't say, as it could have said, any dispute, which is what the broad arbitration clauses say, any dispute arising under this agreement. The fact that they have chosen, knowing full well and having in the past written the broad language in their labor contracts, the fact that they give the jobs monitor only the authority to resolve disputes alleging a breach of the MOU is telling in its own right.
Well, how is a contention that a party is not bound by the agreement because it's been divested not and doesn't intend to comply not a breach of the agreement?
The union didn't allege that the severance of the corporate connection between the signatory entity and the non-signatories that are obligated to make jobs available to the union signatories' employees constituted a breach. That was an action they could have. They could have alleged that this was done to avoid or evade this agreement, but there's no factual question here that Peabody Holding Company violated nothing when it severed its corporate connection. So
the question is whether this MOU, this agreement, survives the severance of the company. That's really the legal question.
The agreement, I think, does survive.
The arbitration agreement survives?
The jobs MOU survives. The jobs MOU was...
Why?
Well, because there are...
That's just inconsistent with what you've just been arguing.
Well, no, Your Honor, it's not because my clients aren't the only companies that were bound to the jobs MOU.
I understand, but you're coming in here and saying that Peabody Holding and Black Beauty are no longer bound by this agreement because of a severance. You're attacking the operation of the whole agreement. It's not a breach of the agreement. It's whether the agreement survives...
With respect to these parties.
Well, sure.
But the question was, does the agreement survive? Yes. The jobs MOU that Heritage Coal signed obligated all of its related entities.
To which your client was a party.
It was a party. But it was a party, Judge Wynn, solely, and could legally only be a party based on the fact that it had common ownership with the signatory entity.
It may turn out, whoever resolves this, if a court resolves it, it may turn out that the court follows the reasoning that just suggested by Judge Wynn. That is, that because Peabody Holding and Black Beauty were bound and signed the original agreement through their agent, that they're going to still have that obligation. But your argument, I gather, raises the question of whether that is so, and that issue is a one that doesn't go to the breach of the agreement itself, but whether it survives at all.
Whether there's any obligation remaining with respect to companies once they exit the group of controlled entities that are lawfully capable of being bound to...
Well, what makes it difficult to understand is that it is clear that if this was a question over whether there was an agreement at all, which is not that question, then we'd be in a different venue. But it seems as though your argument is centered on the fact that there's a dispute over whether this has expired or terminated. Going back to Judge Niemeyer's line of questioning here, it would seem clear to me in that instance that that's a matter that you submit to this monitor, and it can come out your way, it come out other ways, or there may be other avenues. But if all that is the question before us, we're not getting to the bigger question here, because essentially you say you were a party to this agreement.
We were a party, Your Honor, but the issue is, does the loss of the very fact that enables this agreement to function, i.e. common ownership, does it operate to extinguish any future obligation of these companies?
That's just that's inherent in your argument of what you want to have adjudicated by a court. Your argument would be that the severance frustrates the purpose of the agreement because the mines are no longer related, and therefore it's no longer survives.
And that issue, that's our argument.
That's
and
your
that,
argument, but that's not here for us to decide. That's just the nature of the issue.
Correct, and that is why, my time has expired, but if I may answer that question, and that is why the lack of the broad arbitration language, that if this agreement contained a broad arbitration language, we wouldn't be here, and this matter would be referred to the jobs monitor. Our point is that for a number of very logical and very good reasons, the paragraph 14 in the jobs MOU was not written with this broad language, and that the non-signatory companies did not intend and did not grant the jobs monitor the authority to decide whether this legal separation ends the obligations of the non-signatory entities.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Woodruff. Ms. Stern?
If it pleases the Court, I'm Deborah Stern on behalf of the United Mine Workers of America. This case presents two issues which have a certain overlap, and so I think they can be conflated where they need to be separated. And that is where much of the confusion in this case can arise. And I think that that the jobs monitor, Stephen Goldberg, did an excellent job of analyzing it, and I think Judge Brinkma then also did a very good job of analyzing it, and that decision should be upheld. And this is how it breaks out. There was a spinoff. Peabody Holding Company owned Peabody Coal Company, which is signatory union represented. There's a certain jobs MOU, which I see fully familiar with, that provided, that was really negotiated in 93 to deal with jobs displacement that was occurring because of corporate development of non-union mines. And it provided certain job opportunities for unionized miners who were facing this displacement, which occurred very dramatically, I think, in the spinoff in which the union mines, Peabody Coal Company, was essentially spun off, sold, became Heritage, became owned by Patriot, a new corporation. And there is a group of miners in Indiana laid off from what used to be the signatory mines, who find themselves really bereft of any job opportunity.
Let me get to the crux of this, and I'll tell you what I think is before us. And I think before us is the contractual issue of whether this arbitration clause allows the arbitrator to make this decision. And my problem comes from the language that any dispute alleging a breach of this MOU is the scope of the arbitration clause. And alleging a breach of this MOU takes you back to paragraphs 6 and the first part of 14. 6 is the entire obligation, which is basically when there's a job opening, laid off miners of this signatory who have provided notice are given priority in a complex way. And that's the obligation. Paragraph 40 says, in order to effectuate the implementation of this job opportunity provisions in paragraph 6, you'll be subject to a jobs monitor to see whether that's carried out. And that, to me, is the scope of the jobs monitor in the whole case. If there is somebody laid off, has he been hired? Has he been hired prior, accordance with the rules, paragraph 6 obligations? And then the next paragraph says, any dispute alleging a breach of this MOU. It seems to me the whole scope of the agreement is focused simply on monitoring. They don't even call him an arbitrator. It's on monitoring the laid off union members so that they can get a job at these non-union mines on a priority basis. It's a job protection provision. And the jobs monitor serves both as monitor and arbitrator, which is not characteristic of a traditional arbitration agreement. And then the dispute, which is the key to this, any dispute alleging a breach, it doesn't talk about any dispute about this agreement or arising out of it. It says alleging a breach of the paragraph 6 obligations is committed to the jobs monitor to resolve. Now, in this case, think of what the issue is. This case has nothing to do with whether employees laid off have been properly assigned or not. This case arises out of the notion that they sold Peabody Coal, and the question is whether that sale of Peabody Coal affects the core agreement. In other words, as to the non-union mines, does it survive, does it oblige them? That's what they're arguing in their declaratory judgment. That is not a dispute over a breach of this agreement as to whether you assign employees. Now, that's my problem. You can address any part of
it.
I'm going to give you.
I will. And that's where I was trying to provide this background, but that's where there's this sort of this overlap, but there is a distinction, and I will go to it immediately. The scope of the arbitration clause addresses any disputes alleging a breach of the MOU or that may arise concerning the interpretation and application of the MOU. Paragraph 14 of the jobs MOU.
I'm reading it. I don't see that. Any dispute alleging a breach of this MOU shall first be presented in writing to the applicable non-signatory company. And the monitor shall have also to conduct hearings, requests, so forth, necessary to investigate and resolve the dispute, referring to the prior dispute. Monitor shall not have authority to alter, amend, modify, or add or subtract change from this MOU. That last sentence.
Joint Appendix 79. The last sentence.
I know. The last sentence is just the opposite. The last sentence says that this shall not be resolved, and that can that's a negative. That's talking about the scope of the main agreement. Nothing in this MOU shall authorize the non-signatory company.
I disagree, Your Honor. I disagree. I believe that last sentence fully informs the first. I do.
It doesn't. It doesn't inform the first at all. What it does, it basically says, is a bypass of the broader arbitration agreement and the standing agreement between the United Mine Workers to resolve any dispute that may arise concerning the interpretation of the application of this MOU. That can be handled. That's handled under the normal law. But the commitment to the arbitration clause, that's nothing to do with the commitment. That's a bypass.
No, I disagree, Your Honor. I believe that the last sentence doesn't.
Well, if that's your
first
whole case, that sentence.
But, no. Just let me. The NBCWA cannot be utilized to resolve any dispute arising concerning the interpretation or application of this MOU. Why? Because this MOU sets up its
Doesn't
own arbitration
that.
System.
No. It says you can't use the main agreement procedures, the grievance procedure, in the main case of miners, United Mine Workers Agreement, to resolve disputes under this. And it says not only disputes under this, but relating to this. But that doesn't. Those relating to this could be committed to a court.
Well, if
you have to find out whether it's committed to the arbitrator or the court from the where you commit the issue.
Then, if it's committed to the court, I believe Judge Brinkema addressed that, and she said the outcome is the same. Whether there's two parts to this case. The first is, did the spin-off of Peabody?
She didn't decide the issue. She just decided arbitrability.
Correct.
Now, she's wrong on that. She would still have to decide the issue of what is the effect of the sale of Peabody Coal.
The union does not take issue with the sale of Peabody Coal.
No, it's not a question of the issue. It's what does that do to this agreement? His argument is this agreement is inherent in closely related mines where they control all three mines, two non-union and one union, that you take the laid-off union and give them first priority on the non-union mines. That's the argument they make. I don't know if it's a good one or not, but they make that argument. His argument is that when you sever off the union mine from the company, that they no longer have that obligation. I don't know why he doesn't says that. I mean, why can't you operate otherwise? But that's for resolution of the effect of the severance on this agreement.
I believe that's the underlying issue on the merits that's subject ultimately to arbitration. The first issue is, does this contract, this MOU, remain in effect through its state?
However you state that, it doesn't have a thing to do with whether these obligations in paragraph 6, which are the entire obligations under this MOU, whether they're breached. That doesn't have anything to do with the breach. It just has it raises the question about the whole MOU. Is it now enforceable against the non-union mines when the union mines have been sold? That's what he wants to take to court.
Well, I think that this is the union's position then on that, mm-hmm. that there are two issues. The first is the threshold issue. Is there a contract to which Peabody Holding bound itself?
Yeah,
does it
bound
remain
by
in effect? So we know all that. The answer is yes. Is the termination date December 31st? The arbitrator said and the judge said we're going to look at plain language.
That's all decided.
Now, there is a question, but this, I believe, does not go. This goes to the merits of the case. The benefit of the bargain goes to the employees who were on the Peabody Coal Company panel. Now, after this sell-off, you have a group of miners who are in Indiana who essentially have lost their unionized facility, and their only opportunity they would have vis-a-vis their union representation in any way would be just to have these job opportunities at non-union mines. As a practical matter, in light of the spinoff, given that the benefit of the bargain is for active and laid-off employees of the signatory, can they retain the benefit of the bargain based on their status as being in that corporate structure and having been the employees of a Peabody Holding affiliate or subsidiary prior to the spinoff date? Can they hold on to the benefit of that bargain through December 31st, 2011? That question has not yet been answered.
I would be inclined to say, and this is not binding in any way, this is just to advance the argument, I'd be inclined to say you have the better of this argument. If the two non-union mines bound themselves and didn't say whether they're part of our operation or not, they are still going to have to pick up these laid-off workers. But that isn't the issue before us. That's an issue of deciding the effect of the severance on this agreement. And it may be you're going to win that. But the question is the arbitrator the one to decide that? And my only question to you, the arbitrator was, in this case, really is a jobs monitor, was given the power to make sure those employees were properly assigned, that they weren't rejected, they weren't in lower priority. Paragraph 6 gives you the full range of what has to be monitored. And if that's the issue, I don't think, if that's the issue in this case, there'd be any problem. They'd pick up those unemployed people you're talking about and hire them. Their big issue is, since we sold off Peabody Coal, that went to the essence of our whole agreement and we're no longer bound. Not because we weren't signatories. We're no longer bound because of the sell-off. That's their argument. And the question is, who's going to decide that issue? And to me, that has nothing to do with the operation of this agreement. That has a question of whether there is an agreement by change of circumstance, like an act of God.
Right, I believe the correct analysis,
yeah.
The union's position as to the correct analysis, with all due respect, is that the question of whether there's an agreement is answered by the AT&T Technologies analysis. Had the parties agreed to be bound? Yes. Do they have an arbitration clause that covers the dispute? Yes. Is it still in effect?
You have to start
yes.
off by
check,
acknowledging
check, check.
They have an issue. They have a claim. Their claim is, because we sold the union shop, that adversely affected our arrangement, and we're saying this arrangement no longer binds the non-union. You have to accept that as where they want to adjudicate. So let's call that the merits issue. Now the question is, they want to go to court and have a judge decide the merits issue. And you say that merits issue should be decided under this clause, which says any dispute alleging a breach of the MOU should be decided by the jobs monitor.
Correct.
And to me, that's the only debate we have. I think on the merits issue, as I told you, you may have the upper hand. And it seems to me that there's no reason why your union employees couldn't be hired by their non-union mines, just as they obliged themselves, at least up until December 31.
Correct.
But that's why I was confused by when he stated the issue in the beginning, because I think the issue before us is who's going to make that decision in the first instance on his merits issue. And and you understand my problem.
I do.
And I know the last clause has that language, which is a savings clause. It's basically this deal is not going to have an effect on, it's not going to be taken through the grievance procedure of the main collective bargaining agreement.
But that's not to say that interpretation, I mean, look, any agreement, parties might say, we don't understand what this means. Well, that's an interpretation issue. That has to, I mean, by common sense, that has to be available to arbitration, or you can't, you have to know what terms
means. The arbitrator was given, and in this case, the arbitrator was given to resolve, he was given two tasks. This is not a traditional arbitrator. He's not a neutral arbitrator. He starts off by being a monitor. So he's given the task of making sure this mechanism works. And then any dispute about that is held for him more formally through a hearing.
It's issues about job performance, correct. And that is the issue we have after the spin-off.
I don't think you're going to have a dispute on that in this case.
Well, then
I think in this case, those people that are in Indiana who have been laid off, they're union people that have been laid off, I don't believe you'll have a dispute. The jobs monitor will say they have to be hired. The real question is, what was the effect of the spinoff? And the question is that question committed to the arbitrator?
Yes, because it's a performance issue.
Okay.
That's the union's answer. That's our answer.
Let me ask that question.
It's a performance
issue. That's a legitimate argument, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is about performance. Had it not been spun off, there's no question they would be entitled. In light of the spinoff, as a practical matter, given that's active and laid off employees, how do you interpret those terms, active and laid off employees? Does it mean as of today?
See, but that's
or
not
can
an
you
issue.
Say they're, as
they're
of the
going spin-off. To, you're going to win all those things for sure.
I'm not so sure.
So long as this agreement applies, the severance doesn't adversely affect it. If a court were to conclude the severance took away the essence of the agreement, it wouldn't be in effect as to the non-union. So that's the only issue they're raising.
But see, Judge Niemeyer, I'm not so sure the union's going to win that. You're more confident
debated.
Than I am. And the reason I'm saying this in all honesty, I believe it could go either way because it really requires interpretation of what do active and laid off employees mean and what's their status.
There's something that I want to make sure I understand on this case because of the discourse that's going on and where it is here. If we take Peabody as being the initial plaintiff in the case, this wasn't brought by Peabody, it was brought by the union.
Correct.
And what was brought was you breached the agreement. At that point, it would seem to me that what Peabody then does, they come forth with an affirmative defense. And I don't know how we lost focus of the fact that this is all about the first instance of you bringing the claim saying you breached the agreement.
Yes,
and if that's it, then that goes to the monitor. Now, the whole business of whether, in fact, there is an affirmative defense to it may be outside of the scope of it, and it may be, but the initial question of the breach seems to have been brought by the union. And I understand what's going back and forth
Judge
here, but you're confusing me all over the place here.
I'm sorry.
Because I'm getting into the substance of this whole business of whether you're going to win or not. Not really a big deal. The big deal here is this something that goes to the arbitrator, and is this a claim of a breach, and you made it? Why is that so simple to me? Am I oversimplifying
No,
that?
No, Judge Wynn, I think you summed it up. I actually do, and I apologize to the extent that I was not as
did. Well, you're going back and forth on this, and I hadn't heard you say that once, and that's what bothered me on this. Yeah, I hadn't heard you say it once, and you're going back and
but
it
those
was,
are the two parts I'm trying to these are the two parts of the case. The underlying merits is the union's claim to Peabody Holding. As long until December 31st, 2011, you must perform. You're failing to perform. You're breaching an agreement in your failure to perform. Peabody's defense is
that was what was
we're
before,
relieved
that
of
was
the
what
obligation
was before
to
the
perform.
Arbitrator. Is that right?
Exactly. We're relieved. Why are we relieved of the obligation?
So the
to
question
perform?
Is whether the arbitrator could then arbitrate that claim that the union is bringing.
Yes.
What if the union came with affirmative defense and said, we have refused to comply with the paragraph 6 because we've discovered that there was fraud in the entering into the agreement altogether, and the agreement is void ab initio. Is that a dispute?
Fraud is a different issue, I believe.
It is. It's a hypothetical. Absolutely. I'm giving you a
hypothetical. Yes, I think that hypothetical would
Does that go to court?
I believe that it would.
I think it would, too.
Yes, I do.
So the reason it goes to court is not because it's affirmative defense or not, or it's related. It's because it goes to the contract itself. AT&T said the contractual scope is decided by courts.
This case evolved because the union said to Peabody, you are in breach of your obligation to perform. Peabody Holdings said, our spinoff advanced the termination date. In other words, the termination date was December 31st. It has advanced to October 31st. It has been modified and changed by intervening events. And the union said it has not, you
well,
are bound
for
that.
Let's make it more dramatic. Let's take the whole subject matter of a contract disappears by an explosion from the sun. And we have an act of God that is makes it impossible to perform the contract. This is no longer a question of somebody breaching or not breaching. This is a question of the scope of the contract itself. And I think the fundamental law set forth by the Supreme Court is when you look at the, and the Fourth Circuit, is when you look at the scope of the contract, you go to court. When you're construing whether the contract has been complied with in its terms, you go to the arbitrator. Now, in this one, it's even narrower because it defines it has to be alleging a breach as of the obligations in paragraph 6.
I think that if you look at the Interstate Distributor, the Cognizant case, the Parsons, Unite Here, all, they really go, and if, particularly the Renner Center. The question is, once a party says there are these events
well,
that have rendered...
The language is, when there's a question about arbitrability...
And it's
The Supreme Court has said you look at the language and the arising out of or relating to, and as a matter of fact, in Rent-A-Center, they include construction, interpretation, and application, and all that. That was as broad as you can get. And if the parties and choose right. to do that, they right. can do that.
And it was analyzed under the FAA,
yeah.
paragraph
but,
2.
But I go back to AT&T, which still is good law, and we have our case in the Fourth Circuit that has said that, too, Judge Wilkinson's opinion, which talks about the scope of the contract itself. And I understand their issue to be we don't disagree with our obligations under paragraph 6. We know exactly how to handle that. We're saying the agreement's not in effect at all because of interim circumstances that were not anticipated.
That's right. The termination date has been advanced.
My point is that that issue, by the language of the arbitration, wasn't committed to the arbitration.
And your point is that that's a breach.
Yes, absolutely. That is a breach. That's a breach. It's a failure to perform is a breach. The obligation to perform continues. The failure to perform breaches.
That's the same argument
and that the obligation to perform survives as long as the contract survives.
So if
it only
the,
ends when the contract ends.
If the
when does it end? December 31st.
I'm not going to perform because it was fraud.
I spoke over you, Judge.
If the obligor said, I'm not going to perform this contract because there was fraud in the inception, the person, the other obligee says, you're breaching. You have an obligation under this agreement to perform. And the other guy says, I'm not performing because it was fraud. Now, you've conceded that that goes to a court.
I think they're both arguments concerning invalidation of a contract, but I think they are such different arguments that...
I think that's their argument, though the severance had the effect of relieving them of their obligations.
Of terminating this contract,
yes,
really.
Yes.
As if saying, well, fraud would terminate a contract.
Right.
But I believe that, I understand that there's certain analogies that can be drawn, but I think that they are too distinct, and the case law that's evolved under fraud and under events which might advance a termination date are very different types of cases, and I think they're analyzed differently. I think AT&T, as I said, check, check, check. Party, alleging a breach, alleging failure to perform, contract has not yet expired. Check, check, check. There's still a contract. This case should go forward.
Let me ask this regard to AT&T to make sure I understand that case. At least unlike AT&T, this is a case in which it is undisputed that the plaintiff was a party to this agreement. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, this is not so different from the Parsons versus Paramount case, where you had arbitration under the United Mine Workers 1974 pension plan, where the NBCW had expired, and the arbitration was sought under the pension plan. And the court held that, even though the contract had expired, that the trustees had jurisdiction to hear the case because the pension plan remained in effect.
How do you handle Carson, which is our case, Giant Food? Carson said, unless you clearly and unmistakably provide the scope of the arbitration to the arbitrator that it's a contractual issue?
I think you have to understand Carson in context of those facts, which were whether the contract required arbitration of statutory claims, which I believe is a different kettle of fish. It just is. I mean, the statutory claims.
I respectfully submit, this doesn't eliminate your argument, but I respectfully submit that arbitration is a contractually based duty or obligation or right, whatever you want to call it. And to determine the scope of that contract, we use courts and contractual provisions. If we can construe the arbitration clause to commit issues of arbitrability to the arbitrator himself, then using contract language, that's what we do. And I think the beginning and the end of all these cases is to look at the language of the MOU in this case. And when we look at the language of the MOU in this case, there's some serious questions about what the scope is. It looks like it's fairly narrow. It's about as narrow as I've ever seen, arbitration clause. And I mean, it basically says the jobs monitor will see to compliance of paragraph 6 if there's a dispute over a breach of that. But the jobs monitor will decide it. Now, that's pretty narrow. And,
just to address Carson.
And your argument, if I understand it, is simply because you've alleged a breach of the contract because they won't perform. I don't think that answers the question. It depends why they won't perform. It's not that they won't perform by reason of the terms of the agreement. They won't perform because there's no agreement at all. That's what their argument is. And so I don't think that's you can just say because it's breach, it's therefore under it. I think you have to look a little more further and to see what the nature of the issue they're raising. Now, you phrased it, I think, in the most favorable terms for your side, which is the contract calls for termination on 12/31, and they say the contract is now terminated with the sale. And that advances that date, and therefore it's an interpretation of the agreement. That's a closer question, but it still may not be committed because it may be construing the agreement generally and not whether there's been a breach in the way it's operating.
Right. They argue that cancels their obligation to perform.
And I think they argue there's no contract at all because of this intervening event, which is not specified in the agreement itself. They're arguing the bigger picture that the essence of the contract has been changed.
Right, but
I'm not sure they, as I say, I'm not sure they win on that. I genuinely believe that it's hard to make a case that if they were bound by this contract while they owned Peabody Coal, why they're not still bound.
And that issue has come up in numerous cases. I mean, we've recited them. It's Interstate Distributors Cognis, Sage Hospitality, then the 74 pension plan case that I just Parsons. It is not unusual for a party to say, okay, I have a contract, it ends on this date, but you know what, I've got a letter in which you agreed that certain circumstances would have it end earlier, or there's a separate agreement out here, the NBCWA, and that is the termination date that should be looked at. Really extrinsic evidence, and the courts have really consistently held, when you go into that argument.
Take my fraud analogy, and they discover it two-thirds of the way through the contract, and they say, this contract never came into being. It's fraud. It's void ab initio. Then they're moving under your restatement, they're moving the December 31 up to the beginning.
But, Your Honor,
you can always construe it in that fashion, but the long and short of it is they're not bickering with the terms of the agreement. They're bickering with whether the whole agreement is in a play.
But to equate the separate set of events that then change a termination date with fraud would have reversed the results in Interstate Distributor, Cognis, Parsons, then none of those decisions.
You have to look at the arbitration clauses in those, too.
I believe that our arbitration clause is as broad.
Okay.
For the reasons I've stated.
So. Well, this is interesting and tough. And you have any further?
No, thank you.
Questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Woodrum, do you have, are you entitled to rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
I'll be brief. I have 5 minutes, but I don't think I need 5 minutes.
You may.
But I may, depending on your yes, your preference on that.
Well, let me just ask you. I'll just take off where we left off, because the argument that Ms. Stern makes is the contract provides that you have to continue giving these preferences to employees until the end of the year, and that you now have, by whatever reason, advanced that date and therefore breached. A breach is covered by the arbitration clause, ergo, we should affirm.
If I may first, before I forget, I would like to address a question that Judge Wynn had, because the district court judge made the same error we pointed out in our brief. The company in that case, AT&T, was signatory to an agreement. So in that sense, there's no difference between what happened in AT&T and here, because we acknowledge that initially we were bound to this agreement. AT&T was bound as well, because they were actually signatory to a labor contract. And the issue there was, as here, was this specific issue, this specific dispute, one that was covered by the party's agreement to go to arbitration as opposed to go to a court.
Is your allegation, or at least your position, that the arbitration clause has expired or it is terminated by the actions that occurred here?
Not the arbitration clause, Judge Wynn. Judge Niemeyer has stated our case far more succinctly than I've been able to do. That is exactly our position on this, is that we were initially bound to this agreement, and the question is, the substantive question is, does the act of severing the corporate relationship, which was the reason this
now, is that
job opportunity provision
would it be
came
necessary
into being,
for you to add any, to look at that, or once the claim is made that there's a breach, what is needed then to kick it out of arbitration? Is it simply it was flawed, or simply an allegation that we are no longer bound? Then it comes to court?
What kicks it out of arbitration is the fact that the arbitration clause itself, as Judge Niemeyer postulated, it is not a broad arbitration clause. It is a delegation of assignments to an individual the parties chose as the job monitor to monitor those obligations.
Clearly the initial claim that there's a breach is in there. So you're there on that legitimately, and what kicks it out is you say, no, it's not about a breach, it's fraud, it's something else.
It's not about a breach of our compliance with the job opportunity provisions, the mechanics of how that works, who gets the jobs, when they get them, are there exceptions, and so forth, which would go to the jobs monitor.
Their allegation. When they go to the monitor, that's the allegation. My question is what then do you, how do you get it out of there by coming forth with a defense, so to speak, to this, saying, no, our severance relationship, we don't have an agreement at all.
Because if we are no longer subject to this obligation to offer jobs because we're no longer related, there can be no breach if there's no obligation under the agreement.
Doesn't that lend itself to some artful pleading and sort of rebuts the presumption that these issues ought to be arbitrated? I mean, I guess you can conjure up just about any reason to try to get out of a contractual obligation.
Well, these companies have complied with these job opportunity provisions. They didn't try to get out of their obligations. There's no issue of that. And if indeed it's determined that this agreement does continue to apply, who determines that's the issue? But if it does apply, I'm chagrined to hear that Judge Niemeyer thinks we might have the worst part of that, but if it does apply, then the issue could arise as to whether we're breaching it when we make these offers to these people.
I think clearly breaches go to the arbitrator, but when you challenge the arbitrator's power at all because there's no agreement, that's a court decision.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And it doesn't matter whether it's a defense or an affirmative defense or who initiates it. And you're basically saying, I have no more duty. I can't breach it because there's no agreement. Now, the suggestion that you somehow get out of the agreement, and this is where I was sympathetic with Ms. Stern's position, is that the fact that you signed, obliged yourself to hire these people, I don't see how that necessarily changes because that mine is now owned by somebody else. We don't need to argue that.
That's correct.
But
that's the substantive issue.
That's the substantive issue of whether that has the effect of dissolving the agreement. And the existence, vel non, of the agreement is not an arbitrable issue. It's a court issue of contract. And it seems to me it's never been made an arbitrable issue in any arbitration case if you're going to the contraction, the power of the arbitrator altogether. And regardless of how it's raised, it seems to me that has to be your argument. But this might be a good one for you guys to settle. You just go hire those people and go out and buy her a beer and she'll buy you the hot dog.
Let me make sure I understand one point, mate. Do you say there wasn't an agreement? Don't you say there still is an agreement? It's just that it's been terminated insofar as you, right?
Just one digression on the nature of that agreement. The agreement is signed by a signatory entity. That entity still exists. At the time it was signed, it bound all of its related companies. There were seven entities.
The problem I have is paragraph 14 says, disputes alleging a breach. That was done.
But
so then to get it out, regardless of how you postulated, all you got to do is come in and says it's fraud or something else, and it kicks it out, even though it's a dispute alleging a breach.
The position that the legal effect of the agreement severs or terminates with the cessation of the existence of the ability to legally have this type of agreement in the first place under labor law has the effect of severing it. That is not a breach of the job opportunity provisions in this agreement. It's exactly what Judge Niemeyer said.
One last clarification I'll need from you. Are you saying that, in essence, you are challenging this contract as a whole because of the severance? And if the contract is no good as a whole, then arbitration is no good.
The contract no longer applies. The job opportunity agreement ceased to apply to us when the underpinning for it.
I don't understand why you're so conditional. You had seven non-signatories that are part of the Peabody operation, and the one union shop was sold. There cannot be any more agreement if you're right.
Well, and five of the non-union companies were sold with it.
Yeah, well, fair enough. But it doesn't matter. If you're right about your proposition, there just cannot be another agreement.
There's no agreement as
to us. The agreement came
to
an end. The overall agreement and the overall obligation to arbitrate came to an end, if you're right.
That's correct. And indeed, the union has now has a job.
That doesn't mean it wasn't a legitimate agreement up until the event.
Up until the event, yes. We're not questioning its status up until the event. It's the event not the termination date in the agreement. That was still there. It's
but
the
that's
event.
Initiated too. The termination, everything goes when the agreement.
Yes, we're simply no longer bound to that agreement.
And the only question is the debate over whether the agreement survives. Is the debate over that
exactly.
An issue committed to the arbitrator?
Exactly. And our position, just so it's very clear, is not that the union doesn't get that issue resolved. They will be entitled to have a judicial determination of the effect of that intervening event.
Well, probably if you were to succeed, it would be Judge Brinkema just reviewing the merits of the case. She knows the case. She has the case, right? And she decided the legitimacy of the arbitrability. But if we were to say she has to go further, she would just decide the whole thing and say that you are bound by the agreement. And then she would reinstate the arbitration finding, which would be you have to give these people hire.
it would, the substantive decision would be made by her, not by the jobs monitor, because we don't think, now if we then don't implement it.
One discrete question, if it went to a court, as to whether the severance dissolved the agreement.
That's the legal issue, and indeed, we did a two-part appeal. We asked the judge to determine that the jobs monitor didn't have the authority to decide that dispute, that it was properly in her court, and we also asked her to decide it on the merits. She declined to decide it on the merits.
May I ask just one more question? Sure. Mr. Woodrum, Ms. Stern argued, and Judge Niemeyer challenged her on this point regarding paragraph 14, that in fact there are two disparate clauses that grant broader authority to the arbitrator, not just to decide breaches, but to decide interpretations or applications of the MOU. And I don't remember whether or not you actually challenged that issue in your brief. Does it matter?
Oh, it matters a great deal. If indeed the clause had been written to give the jobs monitor that authority, I think this would be a very different case. But Judge Niemeyer is right on point. That clause that both the union and Judge Brinkema relied on to say that the arbitrator had broad authority does not, in fact, is not giving the arbitrator that authority. It's quite the opposite. It's saying that these parties can't use the provision in the base labor agreement that contains that language of broad authority under this jobs MOU. It certainly doesn't give any authority to the jobs monitor, and insofar as it informs anything, it informs our position that the jobs monitor's role here is very confined, and it does not encompass a dispute of this nature that goes to the existence of the
It has to address it broader. When it says it can't go to a grievance under the collective bargaining agreement, which has very broad arbitration, it has to say nothing under this agreement or arising out of this agreement is going to be handled by the collective bargaining agreement. But that doesn't address the flip side, whether this agreement addresses both disputes under this agreement or relating to this agreement.
Right,
disputes
exactly.
Relating to this agreement could still be decided some other mechanism. It basically says the collective bargaining agreement is not given jurisdiction.
That's all it says. And it would have been simple enough, Judge Diaz, for the parties to have said, instead of saying that, they could have said the jobs monitor has the authority to do these things.
Well, I've let you guys both run over. We've gone through red lights and gotten tickets and everything else.
Thank you.
All right, we'll...